I'm Bill Potter, for those of you who don't know me, and it's my privilege to welcome you to the third session of a special series of CNS webinars devoted to nuclear threats and the war in Ukraine. A great deal has been written and said about the political and military dimensions of the war, but relatively little attention has been given to the impact of the course of the war resulting from the possession of nuclear weapons by one of the belligerents. Even less discussion has focused on what the war is likely to mean for the future of nuclear deterrence and arms control, nuclear risk reduction, the so-called nuclear taboo or tradition, the implementation of the NPT, and prospects for future nuclear weapons spread. To help us think through some of these questions, we are very fortunate today to have with us two distinguished speakers, Sir Lawrence Freedman and Ms. Sarah Bidgood. Sir Lawrence Freedman is Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London and often is described as the Dean of British Strategic Studies. He was official historian of the Falklands campaign and was a member of the United Kingdom's inquiry into the Iraq War. Among his many books, the most recent include Strategy, A History and the Future, Strategy, A History, and another volume, The Future of War, I think also subtitled A History. In the very early days of the Russian invasion, I believe the day after it began, Lawrence published an op-ed in which he presciently observed that, and I'm quoting, one of the main reasons why wars can turn out badly, even when they have and launched with confidence, is an underestimation of the enemy, an optimism bias that becomes even more starkly apparent as we enter the second month of the conflict. Our second speaker is our own Sarah Bidgood, director of CNS Eurasian Non-Proliferation Program, who is also a PhD candidate at King's College. Sarah is one of the most prolific authors at CNS, including with respect to nuclear issues related to the war in Ukraine. In an article in Foreign Policy last week, she compares the current U.S.-Russian standoff with the aftermath of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, and I can say is not sanguine about the prospects of U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control if, in fact, we survive this ongoing conflict. So with those few words of introduction, let me turn the floor first to Lori for your opening remarks, and then we'll give the floor to Sarah. So, Sir Lawrence Freedman, you have the floor.
Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be with you, only virtually. And this is a serious time in international history. So these are really difficult and important issues that we're trying to address at the moment. I mean, this is certainly the most significant nuclear crisis probably since Cuba. It's one where nuclear weapons have been talked about a lot. It's a major conflict between a nuclear power and a non-nuclear power, but one that is backed without quite being an ally by NATO countries. And it's one in which the particular reference has been made to nuclear weapons by the Russian leader. So it's a very stark time. And in a way, it's a test of a lot of what people have written about and thought about deterrence and alliance policy throughout the nuclear age. And in a sense, the question is, are we seeing deterrence at work and working satisfactorily? Or are we on the verge of seeing some of those taboos you mentioned, Bill, in your introduction, being breached? So let's just quickly look at how the nuclear issue has evolved in this. I mean, first, you have to keep in mind that as far as Ukraine is concerned, it might have been a nuclear power. It could, if they hadn't given up their weapons with Kazakhstan in 1994, by this time they might have worked out how to maintain them and you get the codes and so on, whether they could or not. Whether that was realistic is another question. But in the Ukrainian mind, they gave up something that might have deterred in return for security guarantees that were absolutely useless. And I think if we're just thinking about how you persuade countries that there are alternatives to their own nuclear weapons in the future, that's an issue. Anyway, Ukraine doesn't have nuclear weapons at the moment, and Russia does. When Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February, he said that foreign powers should not interfere and warned of the consequences if they did. And that was generally taken as a sort of a mild invocation of the nuclear threat. But a few days later, he spoke in much more explicit terms about the deterrent forces and suggesting that in some way they were being put on a greater alert. And what this actually meant in practice is very hard to say. It seems that they've sort of strengthened the command and control a bit. It sort of seems to refer to a notch in the Russian process that most people find difficult to actually identify what it is, but it's certainly not a sort of a DEFCON 4 or 5, but it's serious enough. And the fact that he spoke about it in deterrent terms, I think is probably a reflection of what we might expect, which is it was a sort of stay out warning to NATO. We know what you're doing, you're providing arms to the Ukrainians, can't do much about that. But if you get directly involved, then who knows what will happen, all bets are off. If NATO planes start shooting down Russian planes as part of a no-fly zone, for example, who knows where this will lead. Putin's spokesman recently has talked about nuclear weapons really only coming into play if there's an existential threat to Russia. But you know, in some of the ways they've talked about Ukraine, it seems a tad existential. So it's very difficult to quite work out what they mean. But I think we can assume that this is basically about a war between NATO countries and Russia, not the one with Ukraine. And by and large, you'd have to argue if that was the intention, it's worked. The United States and its allies have been very careful, even while pushing military material into Ukraine, to be very clear that they're not going to get directly involved at all. And despite constant pleas from Kiev, they've refused to countenance, accept the arguments for a no-fly zone, which I think, to be honest, would be a bit problematic anyway. I think Zelensky's used this quite effectively to get other equipment from the West, but he's not going to get a no-fly zone. Now, so that's essentially where we are. I'm not going to talk about what's been going on with civil nuclear power. I think that's dangerous and scary in its own way, but it's a separate issue. So the question now is, well, what happens given that the optimism with which Russia launched this invasion, which didn't last probably more than half a day, is now turning into embarrassment and concern that instead of just not winning in Ukraine, they may actually be losing. And there is counter-offensives and a complete humiliation. Will they do something? Well, we had an announcement not long ago from the Russians that they intend to concentrate on the Donbass region, which sort of makes sense, although it's not as straightforward as that sounds. It does suggest that they've recognized that they're not going to take Kiev and Kharkiv and Odessa and so on, but it begs the question of what they're going to do with all the forces that are already close to those cities. Either they leave them there, in which case you've got the problems of Ukrainian counter-offensives and keeping them supplied, or else they bring them back, in which case you've got vulnerabilities of retreating forces and the Ukrainians can follow them and so on. So it's not clear what this means. But certainly one of the things that people have worried about is that a desperate Putin who doesn't want to abandon his main objectives will double down and escalate in some way. So the Biden administration has warned about possible chemical weapons use, and some people have talked about tactical nuclear weapon use. I think, given that we're talking about Putin, who has just done a very foolish thing and a very terrible thing in launching a war, one hesitates to be at all sanguine about what's likely to happen. All one can say, it makes no military sense to start using chemical weapons or tactical, so-called, but short-range battlefield nuclear weapons in these circumstances, simply because of many of the other likely consequences for your own troops. But it's also like the attacks on cities. They have no effect on the military outcome, as we're seeing in Mariupol. Just because you've battered a place to smithereens doesn't mean to say that it's easier to take it. And it certainly doesn't mean that the people are more ready to surrender. So they would be important as political signaling. And it was interesting in the NATO meeting yesterday that there was a clear reluctance on the part of Biden and the other countries to give a sort of an assurance that chemical weapons would not be followed by some strong response by NATO. So I think the risk at the moment is that something awful enough happens, even beyond the awful things that have already happened within Ukraine, that draws in NATO countries on behalf of Ukraine in some way, and one thing leads to another. I think we're somewhere from that. And I think one always has to keep in mind that even when these things happen, everybody goes out of their way to try to find options that don't involve it's not going to be a sudden rush to nuclear use. But it's the sort of thing people have feared about when the passions are high and the stakes are high, that one thing can lead to another and a situation may get out of control. So I think that's the major risk at the moment. And say I wouldn't put it high, but it's not zero, and something that people worry about. So where does this leave us? I mean, Sarah, I think, going to talk more about the arms control implications of this. I think, the basic problem is that so long as Putin is in place, it's very hard to see how Russian, US, Russian, Western relations can recover easily from this. Sanctions are going to stay in place. The role of sanctions is, is going to be a big issue anyway in any peace settlement. So we've got a problem. We're going to, and it could well be that if the Russians do basically concentrate on the Donbas, we're just going to have a war of attrition along the sort of east and south of Ukraine that could go on for some time. So these are not propitious conditions for arms control. And all one can say is that communications have been kept going. The Americans and the Russians have talked to each other. French and Germans have kept up some sort of dialogue with Putin. That side of things has sort of worked. But the idea that this will be a time when you get major new agreements in place seems unlikely. And as always with these things and with arms control more generally, it's worth noting, and this is my final point, that when it comes to the crunch, people don't worry about the numbers. They're not sort of saying, look at the start limits. That gives them no comfort at all. I mean, people are looking at Russian doctrine, they're looking at short range systems, they're looking at they're looking just at the very possibility of nuclear use. I don't think an arms control agreement that had been agreed before is relevant. You know, what's relevant are hotlines and forms of communication, which I saw Avner's comment. I mean, they're undoubtedly at lower level rather than at senior level, but there are low level conversations going on between the two. Those sort of things are important. But at the moment, arms control itself has not really made much difference to the situation in which we face ourselves. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laurie. And I'll turn to Sarah in just 1 second, but kind of also prompted by Abner's comment in the chat. I do think it's important for us to kind of understand, if we can, you know, why, you know, at the senior level, I mean, Gerasimov, certainly among others, is not returning, but I understand there have been multiple efforts to try to engage him. I think that is, you know, disconcerting, and perhaps we can have some further discussion of that in the Q&A, or if Sarah wishes to address it. And I see we have other people like Rose Gottmuller and others on the call here. They may want to weigh in as well. But Sarah, let me turn to you first, and then we'll open it up for Q&A.
Great. Thank you so much, Bill. Laurie, thank you so much for those comments. I am going to build upon them and talk a little bit about sort of what I see coming on the arms control side of things. In Bill's kind introduction, he made reference to a piece that I published recently in Foreign Policy that looks at lessons to be learned sort of from the Cuban Missile Crisis, perhaps not in the traditional way that that's been done, and what they might tell us about how arms control could look after the dust settles. And as Bill alluded to, it's not a very sanguine picture. So I thought I would cover a couple of those points and then talk a little bit about some implications for the NPT as well as risk reduction, and then welcome any questions or comments from our audience. So for me, you know, I think one of the comments that I have heard in general is that it's early to begin talking about consequences for arms control where there's still a ground war going on. And I can understand, you know, how that perspective is supported. But I do think it's really important that we begin to look at what the longer term consequences of this war, this tragic war, is going to be for the nonproliferation and arms control architectures, because we need to be prepared for what's coming down the pike. And as a person who really loves history and is very historically oriented, I often look to the past to see what we might expect coming down the road. And given that we hear this crisis compared so frequently, and just heard it indeed in Laurie's comments, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think that is one historical antecedent that, although not perfect, can give us some clues about what we might expect. The challenge, though, is that, you know, we often hear the Cuban Missile Crisis referred to as the kind of jump starter or the driver behind US and Soviet arms control in the modern era. And I think the question for us will be, you know, can we expect something similar in this instance? You know, will peering over this nuclear precipice drive Washington and Moscow back to the negotiating table? Or conversely, will we see the beginning of a new arms race, perhaps with more dangerous features than what we've seen in the past? It is true, when you look at the historical record, that the period of time after the Cuban Missile Crisis took place, starting in about 1963, was very prodigious. That 5 years that followed, you know, gave us things that we still rely upon today. We've already made reference to and invoked the hotline agreement. We had the Limited Test Ban Treaty. We had the Outer Space Treaty. We had even our beloved NPT, which is something we talk about frequently here at CNS. Does that mean, you know, should we expect that from this tragedy that we're seeing unfolding in Europe, a similarly prodigious period of arms control in the aftermath? And here is where things get a little bit glum, because I really have my doubts that that's something we should expect. When in fact you start to take a deeper look at the historical record, there are nuances about the ways in which arms control developed in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis environment that should really temper our expectations for today and tee us up for the hard work that is going to need to take place in order to get things back on track, if indeed we're able to do that. So a few observations from that history. You know, first and foremost, the Cuban Missile Crisis led to feelings of deep mistrust and acrimony between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. Kennedy and Khrushchev had a very difficult relationship in the months that followed the Cuban Missile Crisis, in part because, as we know from the documentary record, Kennedy felt betrayed by Khrushchev's behavior. And that made arms control almost impossible for at least 8 months after that crisis took place. By the spring of 1963, the two sides, which had resumed negotiations on a comprehensive nuclear test ban agreement, were deadlocked over the issue of verification. And verification is important here. I'm going to come back to that point a little bit later. The main issue that the two sides proved unable to resolve was what would constitute adequate on-site inspections. So for Kennedy, having a certain number of on-site inspections on the ground in the Soviet Union was crucial for him securing domestic political support to ratify any agreement that might come out of these negotiations. But for Khrushchev, Kennedy's insistence upon these on-site inspections seemed like a pretense for spying on Soviet activities on the ground. And this was an unreconcilable, these were two unreconcilable positions. The two sides were only able to make progress and break through this stalemate when Kennedy declared a unilateral moratorium on US nuclear testing in June of 1963. That was sort of the step that allowed Khrushchev to accept negotiations on a limited test ban agreement rather than a comprehensive test ban agreement. And the two sides were eventually able to come to an agreement on the limited test ban treaty very shortly thereafter. So that's one thing that I think we need to bear in mind. This was not a natural evolution from a crisis to this prodigious period in arms control. There was also this trough in relations that I think should inform our expectations today. Another observation from this history is that the Cuban Missile Crisis did help to create sort of a bureaucratic or parochial environment where Kennedy was able to promote some of the arms control initiatives that he believed were really important and that he and Khrushchev had begun working on prior to the crisis. These included things like negotiations on a, you know, albeit comprehensive test ban, which started under Dwight Eisenhower, as well as some preliminary conversations about what it would look like to have a direct communication link between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union, although these didn't really gain a lot of traction and didn't go too far. It's really interesting to look at Kennedy's arms control agenda because he actually prepared this very replete menu of options in 1961 that he presented at the UN General Assembly that year. And if you take a look at what some of the specific things that he proposed were, you actually see the kernels of a lot of the agreements that we saw subsequently taken up by different US administrations, including things like the NPT. So he came into office enthusiastic about arms control and really having drunk the Kool-Aid about why it was important to reduce the threat posed by nuclear weapons. The Cuban Missile Crisis may have driven those home to him, but it didn't convince him initially that that's what needed to happen. I do have to wonder, you know, this is a lot of times people use counterfactuals to study the Cuban Missile Crisis, and one that I don't have a good answer to is, you know, had there not been this very replete menu of arms control agreements or at least initiatives that Kennedy and Khrushchev were kind of working on prior to the crisis, would we have seen the same outcome after the Cuban Missile Crisis took place, where we did start to see progress on a lot of these issues? I'm not sure, but that has really significant implications for us at a time when the United States and the Russian Federation have not engaged in formal arms control negotiations since the conclusion of the New START Treaty. A third observation before I move on here is that, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis may have helped to create these environments where progress on arms control was possible after this initial lull, but it also marked the beginning of this enormous Soviet buildup in its nuclear arsenal. So between 1962 and 1968, the US stockpile grew, you know, it's hard to describe this as sort of modestly, but only about 16%, under 20%. But the number of Soviet warheads in that arsenal tripled. That's a huge increase. I really admire Bill Perry, and he writes about this in his memoirs. And he recalls feeling that it was so surreal that at this moment where the two great nuclear powers had been brought to the brink, rather than finding ways to cooperate to actually reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons, they concluded some agreements like the Limited Test Ban Treaty, but then also began to increase the size of their arsenals. And he describes this as kind of a surreal climate. I think that should inform our expectations for what we have today, in particular because you know that there will be domestic policymakers and domestic stakeholders in both Russia and the United States who conclude from this war that more nuclear weapons are needed for deterrent purposes rather than fewer. So I think that's something that's really important for us to recall. So my bottom line here is that as you may have gathered if you've been listening, is that I don't think that this crisis will have a positive impact on the future of arms control between Russia and the United States, at least for the foreseeable future. And that can be true even if the crisis drives home to policymakers and to domestic constituents why arms control and why nuclear risk reduction are more necessary than ever. Those things can be true at the same time. For me, I think that the biggest challenge is going to be overcoming this sense of mutual mistrust, mutual acrimony, mutual suspicion that we can already see beginning to take hold and deepening in the context of this crisis. I get the sense from statements that are coming out of Washington, D.C., for example, that American policymakers regard Putin's sort of cavalier use of veiled nuclear threats and signals as irresponsible nuclear behavior. That's going to take a long time for them to get over. And we know that emotions really matter in the doing and the implementation of policy and diplomacy. I also think something that we can expect as a result of this is that arms control is going to be held hostage to this war. And that there's going to be a tendency on both sides to withdraw from negotiations as a punitive measure, as a way of punishing the other side. We're already starting to see something like this happen. So a couple of weeks ago, Dmitry Medvedev, the former president of Russia, suggested that, you know, maybe Russia would consider withdrawing from the New START treaty in response to US sanctions. The United States has already suspended its strategic stability dialogue, which was the one forum for conversations about the future beyond New START that the United States and Russia had in place. Now, I'm not comparing those two things. I understand why it was that the United States felt that the strategic stability dialogue forum was not really viable at this moment, but I do worry that the longer that it remains on ice, the more difficult it's going to become from a political and from a bureaucratic standpoint to start that back up. As I said previously, I am certain that there will be people in the US and in Russia who conclude from this crisis that more nuclear weapons are needed to serve national security interests. And if that happens, even if the strategic stability dialogue gets going again and negotiations restart, it's going to be difficult for them to ratify any agreements that might come out of that. So even if the two sides are able to kind of make it back to the negotiating table, I also think that this climate of mistrust that I've described previously and this impetus to make the other side pay for what they have done is going to make it very difficult for negotiators to show the kinds of flexibility that are necessary to reach an agreement. And I think just as we saw in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, this is going to lead to a fixation on so-called ironclad verification mechanisms, which we know is an elusive term that doesn't really actually materialize in practice, that could come at the expense of negotiations as a whole. So Bill, I would just say two things by way of conclusion here. You know, we're talking here about arms control in particular, but of course, arms control is one piece of this broader non-proliferation regime. We do have the upcoming 2022 NPT review conference. There are so many ways in which this crisis is going to have a really significant impact on what that review conference looks like. But one of them is going to be this deep frustration that is already felt on the part of non-nuclear weapon states about what they perceive as the slow progress towards the implementation of Article 6 and nuclear disarmament under the NPT itself. It will certainly not help things if there is absolutely no demonstration of the ways in which the United States and the Russian Federation are engaging in good faith negotiations towards the conclusion of these agreements. The one bright spot I could possibly see is that there could be interest in resuming nuclear risk reduction measures or having further conversations within the context of the P5 process about how to put some meat on the bones of what has been longstanding enthusiasm for nuclear risk reduction, but hasn't really translated into action. The only reason I see that being slightly more promising than arms control is that there are measures that could be multilateralized that exist already for nuclear risk reduction between the United States and the Russian Federation. So that would at least provide a framework to begin work from rather than starting from scratch, but I'm not optimistic. So on that very sort of somber and glum note, I think I will stop here for now, but I'm really looking forward to the conversation and would welcome any questions from anyone. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I suspect that Lori may want to comment on some of your remarks as well. But what I would propose is first, let me encourage those of you who would like to ask questions or make short interventions to use the raise hand function I'll see if people, in fact, take advantage of that. And if I miss anything, Caitlin can call to my attention. Let me, as people perhaps think of questions that they'd like to raise, let me share with you an observation, which is actually even more pessimistic than what the two of you have noted. Because I've, at some level, have sought to distinguish what we are hearing from the Russian government and from Mr. Putin from other interlocutors on the Russian side with whom, CNS has had a very, very long experience. And I was distressed after participating in several post-invasion nuclear dialogues with Russian colleagues, where I saw really preposterous demands related to any future neutral status for Ukraine, including insistence that there be revised conditions for continued NPT membership with no withdrawal provisos, a loss of control over civilian nuclear power facilities on their territory, and other demands which are absolutely contrary to NPT provisions and other international arrangements. So I'm kind of curious, and so that was not a good signal since these were not official government parties who were speaking here. So I would like to maybe hear from either of you at some point in the conversation, if you have any thoughts about what political and or military neutrality might mean with respect to nuclear arms control and non-proliferation obligations, because if we are in fact able to negotiate our way out of this conflict, I think some aspect of neutrality is likely to be a component of that, and that has implications also for nuclear arms control and non-proliferation. But let me see, am I simply missing hand? I'm trying to.
I think Rose and Avner both have their
hands. Okay, Rose, why don't I? Sorry, I'm kind of slow in. Okay, good. I see Rose, Avner, and Jeff Knopf all have their hands up. So Rose, I'm delighted that you could join us here, and it's nice to see you. I hope to be able to see your face as well here. I see you on television all the time now, but I'm glad you've joined us virtually.
Yes, it's frightening, isn't it? I am actually going to give you all a question, or Lori and Sarah anyway, a question that I'd would help me with my many television appearances. But first, I want to make two little comments. First, a small ray of hope, or brightness, I should say, at this moment of grave despair. And that is the Russians have continued to implement the New START treaty. They have continued to pass regular notifications of the movements of their strategic delivery systems. It's a routine thing, we notify each other when we move like an ICBM to a maintenance facility or back from maintenance to operational deployment. So there has been a continuation of a New START implementation up to this point. The on-site inspections had been suspended due to the COVID pandemic, and they were due to get started again in June. It will be interesting to see once June comes whether on-site inspection can begin again under New START. I, for one, would hope so, because the treaty is in force and will stay in force until February of 2026, unless Dmitry Medvedev, I suppose, pulls the trigger on his threat, or his government does. Now, the comment that I have is that, the additional comment I have is that the situation is different, I think, Sarah, from the Cuban Missile Crisis, in that President Biden has described President Putin as a war criminal. And Putin's government, the Kremlin, has shot back that that is unwarranted and unforgivable. So I think we must, another kind of dark notion here is that we don't have the advantage, which is necessary for successful top-level negotiations, of the president's willing and able to engage. And so that is something that I think we also have to contemplate right now, is that we will have the absence of, certainly I would say, Biden's presence in efforts to deal with Putin going forward, even on this critical area of strategic nuclear arms control. I think we do have a responsibility to try our best, nevertheless, to move forward. And I have pushed that notion out, just as you did, Sarah, in the remark that we need to think about in due course, not now, but in due course, how to get back to the strategic stability talks. That said, I had a question for both Lori and Sarah, which is, people ask me, well, what if the line is crossed to weapons of mass destruction use, chemical or heaven forbid, nuclear use? And everybody says that the reaction will be incredible and it will be so strong and it will be, but what is that reaction? What should we be thinking about doing? I've talked about additional layering on of the egregious assault on the international law regimes that Putin has unleashed. I suppose more sanctions and things like that, but I would be very interested in how you would answer that question should you be asked that on TV.
Okay, thanks so much, Rose. Lori, you wanna help Rose prepare for her next interview here?
Yeah, well, I've been asked the question too. Can I just make a few points, because quite a lot of observations have already been made. And I'll conclude with Rose's point. First, yeah, this crisis conflict may not end with Putin in power. I mean, it's not inconceivable that if his armed forces are as humiliated as they have been, and he can't retrieve the situation, that he'll be out. Now, it'd be a foolish person who relies on that or predicts that, but it's not impossible. I mean, this is a big failure. I mean, it's a complete failure for Russia, what's happened so far. Enormous cost, tremendous sanctions, international isolation, no friends, nobody really speaking up, apart from maybe North Korea, on Russia's behalf. So don't... You know, The world going forward from this will not necessarily have the same political players in the same position. And even on the Gerasimov point, you know, where's Gerasimov been for anybody? Where should you been for anybody? I mean, maybe they're in disgrace. We don't wholly know what's going on in Moscow. So, you know, I don't want to go, you know, super optimistic in the other direction and say we're going to have coups on. I just don't know. I think they're paralyzed in Moscow at the moment about decision making. But it may be different because we'll have a different regime. With Putin, certainly, it's difficult. Secondly, I like Sarah, I enjoy the history. I think the political context is also important. It wasn't just the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was the Sino-Soviet split that made possible the partial test ban treaty and so on. And of course, China-Russia relations are also things to watch at the moment, and they too will have a bearing on arms control possibilities. And the Chinese clearly, while not wishing to break with their new friend, Mr. Putin, are not very happy with him and certainly not keeping their distance from what he's doing. Third point, on the neutrality, I don't think this will end. I think the Ukrainians are prepared to accept some form of security guarantee arrangement, which would be an alternative to joining NATO. I think concepts of neutrality are historic concepts bound up with concepts of international law and so on, which I don't think are going to have a lot of relevance in this situation. What security guarantees mean after Budapest and so on is also another question, but that's going to be what it's about. And then on to Rose's point. I mean, I found it, if it wasn't so sad, almost amusing, the way that the Russians reacted so strongly to Biden calling Putin a thug and a war criminal, when they're being castigated daily for crimes against humanity and beating up on Ukrainian cities. But it indicates how personal this is for Putin. And I think that's something that is a worrying and complicated part of the situation. What do we do if they do something terrible? I think we'd do something. I don't think it would be credible to just express displeasure or serious concern. But I think it would be conventional. And I think it would be interesting to see if there are what sort of things are being planned that would possibly enable Ukraine to take more military initiatives than it was otherwise doing. But I think the fact is this issue will only arise if Russia is really losing badly. And if they're really losing badly, then conventional options may not be the main thing. But I think it was right for Biden not to be too specific, not unlike the no-fly zone where he absolutely ruled it out. But in this case, you've got to keep the Russians guessing. I don't really know what we do. I don't doubt if Biden or Blinken or anybody else really knows what we do, however much they think about it, but nor does Putin. And that's, in a sense, another form of deterrence.
Thank you, Laurie. Sarah, would you like to also weigh in on that?
Yeah, I was taking feverish notes, though, because I also have an interview coming up, and I'm sure I'm going to get that question. So, it's a great question, Rose. I mean, you would obviously know this better than I would, given your role at NATO, but my understanding is that, some of this depends a little bit on sort of where would any kind of radioactivity or chemical weapons, aftermath end up wafting. And if it goes over into a NATO country, then I think that the options are a little bit different than they would be if Putin used a nuclear weapon or a tactical nuclear weapon against Ukraine and it was somehow contained in Ukraine, which I can't really imagine. And then my thought is that, as others have argued, there doesn't have to be an automatic nuclear response to something like that. It could be a really significant retaliatory conventional strike, which could offer one way of kind of credibly responding to something like that while not escalating the situation in the same way that the introduction of nuclear weapons on the part of NATO would. But it is I also don't know the answer, of course, and it seems like there is some benefit to strategic ambiguity there, as Laurie was just saying. So perhaps that's something we'll hopefully not have to actually find out. And Rose, I'll just thank you for your kind of reminder too about the fact that one of the challenges for arms control in the aftermath of this crisis will be kind of the implications of the fact that the two leaders are not really engaged on, will have difficulties in engaging with one another on arms control related issues for the reasons that you cited. I mean, the other thing that came to my mind as well is that, how will domestic appetite for arms control or any kind of negotiations with Russia change in the aftermath of this crisis, in part because Biden has now described Putin as a war criminal. So that's also something that we have to think about as well. The landscape for the domestic legitimation of treaties and agreements becomes much less hospitable when there is that kind of rhetoric. And so I think that's a challenge we're going to have to pay particular attention to, and one that, as an American citizen who's watched partisanship play out in our political system for years now, I find very worrisome and dismaying. So thanks, Bill, back to you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I'll call on Abner. I also in the future, you may want to also comment on the potential implications of Belarusian entry more formally into the war. I think that is probably a more likely development going forward, which would also merit a serious response. And presumably we're thinking about that, but I think that's another item that we may want to talk about. Abner, I'd be pleased to recognize you.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Good, excellent. Thank you very much for the fascinating discussion. It's intriguing, but even more so sober. And I think that my comments would be on this continued, that sense of sobriety. Sarah mentioned that many people, including myself, refer to Putin's irresponsibility behavior in terms of leaders who behave irresponsibly in his possession of nuclear weapons. The more I think, it's much worse than that. It's actually taking advantage of the ambiguity of nuclear weapons, of the threats of nuclear weapons, and essentially becoming a bully of nuclear weapons, mid-sized country in terms of economy, who is using its nuclear weapons to create and to enhance a sense of ambiguity and sense of scare about his possession of nuclear weapon. It's much worse than just being irresponsible. It's taking advantage of that ambiguity in that very critical moment. And that's, I think, for the first time in the nuclear age, during crisis, we have a leader of nuclear power who is in confrontation with a country that gave up what that country had, and now is taking full advantage as a bully with that kind of possibility. This is the first time we have, and the question is how the international community treats that kind of thing, creating what I call a zone of immunity, essentially allow himself to do devastation, atrocities, war crimes, and we have to witness by just watching it and doing nothing. He has been quite successfully in doing that. He forced us with our overcaution, our, the West, over a sense of caution. And essentially we are just sitting there and seeing the atrocity taking place. So that's one sense of severity that we see of the crisis. I want to mention quickly two or three other things. Dmitry Medvedev, the former president of Russia, gave some comments recently, which were very, very sobering. He mentioned that the pressure on Putin could ultimately bring to the split of the of Russia into a number of states, could be much worse than Putin, kind of saying that at least right now you have somebody with some kind of experience. If we're going to put more pressure, it could be even worse. So that's another way to try to use the kind of scare and essentially giving this space or zone of immunity to Putin. And his comments were quite needs to reflect. The other thing is more analytic point, and I wonder what both Bill, Sarah, and Laurie think about it. You know, the Budapest memo was referring to actually to assurances, security assurances. It was not security guarantees. And it kind of makes the difference. It was from the beginning a little weaker and somewhat more loose because assurances are not as strong as security guarantees. So one wonder what kind of future settlement or some kind of thing outside NATO could look like if you want to look for guarantees. So to look for something else outside NATO, but yet with the power which would be very close to being a member of NATO, you really wonder what kind of arrangement you can find in that kind of space. And finally, there was a very fascinating piece that came out in The Economist about the nuclear aspect. And they reminded us Herman Kahn and his thinking about the unthinkable and the fact that Herman Kahn has some 40 or so ranks in this letter. So conceptually, you can think about all sorts of elaborate ways to escalate, but in the messy reality of the practice, it's very, very difficult it's very, very blurry. So even though conceptually you can be quite elaborate and all that, in reality, it's much more blurry and quite uncontrolled. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Avner. Would one or both of you like to respond to Avner's points? Laurie, you want to start?
I want to start. Fascinating point. First, it's not wholly new, the situation, because in 2014 they did the same thing. That they also drew attention to their nuclear arsenal in 2014. Putin was perfectly explicit about how the West should not interfere because Russia is a nuclear power. And in fact, they did lots of menacing things around and about Europe, and sort of overflights and buzzing ships and so on, to indicate the dangers of war. So it's not wholly new. And you know, I think one of the things for the West to contemplate is why we sort of let things ride after Crimea and what happened initially in the Donbass as we did. Secondly, on the Budapest, I was quite right that it talked about assurances rather than guarantees, though I understand there were issues in translation as well there, as there always are. I think there's an important difference. On the one hand, we could be talking about an Article 5 that if you are attacked, oh, Ukraine, then we are obliged to come in on your behalf. But then there's another meaning of it all, which is we won't attack you, which seems to be a pretty clearer obligation, whether you're talking about assurances or guarantees. And, you know, when Lavrov was challenged about that, he said, well, you know, the government has no legitimacy because it's a bunch of Nazis. Well, you know, I mean, that's not how it works. It's not true. It's not how it works. So this now causes all the problems with a peace settlement, because any new arrangement has to offer something. And how can you rely on it? On the escalation ladder, and, you know, escalation started as a tragic concept. It was about how things could get out of control. And then Khan came along and was trying to demonstrate how you could keep control even to the ultimate ultimate all-out exchange. So the thing, there were 44 rungs on the escalation ladder, and I think it was after rung 15 that you started using nuclear weapons. And we find it almost impossible now to think in those terms. Khan had a gift for it. But I think the, one of the things Cuba did, I think, was when it came to it, people actually didn't think really in very subtle moves. And I don't think people are thinking in subtle moves. And in anticipation, they think of Armageddon. And that's probably in anticipation a good thing, but in the reality, it's not such a good thing, because you'd want to find other things that you could do that fell far short of that. And that goes back to the early discussion with Rose. Just finally on Belarus, I don't think Belarus entering the war is a big deal. I mean, their army's pretty meager. They've been, it's been an on-off entry into the war. They've been, there's been a lot of sabotage of their logistics already. I think the Ukrainians are waiting for them. The ground's pretty boggy when they arrive. I think, you know, Lukashenko is Putin's Mussolini, but I don't think that's a game. It's not a game changer. It might be for Belarus in the end, but because I think they're a weak link, but I don't think it's the main thing that worries Ukraine at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Laura. I won't respond, but I will let Sarah speak.
Okay, well, I was actually going to pick up on this point about the ladder, because I am really interested in sort of the ways in which escalation could play out in the context of this crisis. And I think that that gets back to our earlier questions with which we began the panel. You know, what is the actual risk of nuclear use as it relates to the war in Ukraine? I think one of the challenging things for me as an analyst who is looking at that question is, I'm not exactly sure that we all agree on what the rungs on the escalation ladder are at this point. So there's kind of an epistemic issue there, where I'm not sure that we fully understand what Russia considers to be the rungs on the escalation ladder in the context of this crisis in particular. And I'm thinking here about the announcement on, what was it, February 27th, that Putin was placing Russia's arsenal on this special command. There was a lot of confusion, as we all remember, in the West about what exactly that meant. How do we interpret that? What does that mean? There was later some clarification, but that gets at this very issue. That was a step up in the escalation ladder, but we weren't exactly clear on what it meant in the West. And so when there is ambiguity there, you know, I think that that can be something that is particularly challenging. It's also challenging because we know that, you know, by looking at Russian strategy, Russian force posture, Russian doctrine, that the way in which they envision managing escalation does involve nuclear weapons. After they've exhausted their conventional capabilities, that is when you could potentially see the introduction of nuclear weapons into a conflict if Russia is faced with an existential threat. For me, the big questions are, you know, when does Russia regard its conventional capabilities to have been exhausted? And also, what does Putin consider to be an existential threat in the context of this crisis? Is it, you know, him personally, when he feels that he is losing power, that is an existential crisis? Or does it relate to the territorial integrity of the Russian Federation as it is described in formal Russian declaratory policy? You know, those are questions that I don't know the answer to. And I think that means that as Putin is kind of invoking these threats to move the escalation ladder, move up and down on the escalation ladder in ways that he thinks serve his purposes in this conflict, it opens the door to the potential for severe miscalculation, misinterpretation, miscommunications that we then can't control because they're kind of outside of the bounds of the way that we conceive of moving up and down the escalation ladder. So that's a real place of concern for me. I think I'll leave it there for a second and go back.
Thanks, Sarah. We have Jeff Knopf and Sig on in line here, but I want to follow up on something that you just mentioned, because I have some concerns about somehow conflating, you know, Russian declaratory policy and how we think that Russia should respond and the personalist nature of what appears to be, you know, Russian decision making at the moment. And I think it's useful. I'm glad that Lori kind of mentioned the saber rattling in 2014, because that time also corresponds to a series of statements that Mr. Putin made to the effect, and Sarah cited one of these in her recent piece in the New Statesman, that, you know, death is beautiful. I think the expression was among the mirror, among the community, you know, or with friends. The idea that he was very explicit, that there's no point in having a world without Russia. And then more recently, last week, there was also a statement that he made at the soccer stadium that there's no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. I mean, that suggests that, and we have to be careful about psychoanalyzing Putin, but I think it's as important as looking at formal Russian declaratory policy, given what we, at least some of my experts like Nikolai Sokov and others suggest have been a major departure in terms of the statements from actual declaratory policy. So, I think we have to be very careful here and also examine closely what I see as an exaggerated sense of Mr. Putin and probably other leaders as well, kind of control over escalation, a faith in technology, which I think is unfounded. And I think that regardless of the number of rungs that, you know, Herman Kahn may have identified, I'm not sure that there are nearly as many relevant rungs in the mindset that President Putin has at the moment. So I kind of throw that out there. If you want to respond now, you can, or you can do it. But Sarah, you want to?
I do. I mean, I think that's a well-made point, Bill. And I know we've had other conversations about this, so it's somewhat coordinated perhaps. But, you know, I think to pick up on one of the points that you made at the beginning of your remarks, I mean, we are dealing with a situation, in my view, that is outside of the scope of declaratory policy. It isn't just that Russia has, or that Putin is using, you know, is departing from declaratory policy, and that puts us in some uncharted territory. It's that declaratory policy is about deterring adversaries from attacking Russia. It's not about providing cover for Russia while it attacks a third party. And so I think those who seek comfort from analyzing declaratory policy and saying, well, you know, Russia doesn't seem likely to use nuclear weapons because this doesn't really fit the scenarios that are laid out in declaratory policy, are kind of missing the point. We're in this new land where it's not really clear that we are even in the scope of an issue that declaratory policy would necessarily apply to. And that is also anxiety producing, because it means that there are these questions about how might Putin's own, you know, kind of personalist leadership style and his own thinking, again, not to psychoanalyze, you know, inform the way that he invokes and then acts upon nuclear threats in this uncharted landscape. So I'm glad that you raised that. I mean, I think that's a perspective that we both share.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Jeff Knopf, I know you've also written things in the chat, but why don't we take advantage of your presence? Let me just ask Caitlin, do we only have, we don't, can't actually see, I mean, I see Jeff's, you know, face picture, but we're not able to get people, live persons other than the speakers?
I can promote them to a panelist. It would just take them outside of the webinar and bring them back in. So it might just have a few second delay.
Okay, well, in any case, Jeff, why don't you start, and then if we see you live, that's all
Okay, well, can you guys hear me all right?
We can hear you though, thank
okay.
you.
So I have, it's a comment, but we could imagine a question mark at the end of it, because I would love to hear Sarah and Lori's and Bill, if you want your responses. I've been thinking a lot about the discourse that has emerged around the proliferation implications of this crisis. And I think there's an almost celebratory tone about, you know, this war is showing why nuclear weapons are really great after all, and it's going to be the death knell for the non-proliferation regime, and a great advertisement for why everybody should go out and get themselves a nuke. And I think that talk is at best incomplete and narrow in its focus. So, you know, if we attempt to put this in sort of a cost-benefit framework, it on the one hand ignores all of the well-known costs and risks that come with trying to pursue a nuclear weapon. But I think I actually think it also gets the benefits part wrong. And there's been insufficient attention so far to the limits of having a nuclear weapon. So clearly the one thing that Russia has bought for itself is that it has deterred types of military intervention that could lead to direct Western Russian combat that could escalate to nuclear war. And so threats at a very high level are very effectively deterred by nuclear weapons. But below that level, I actually don't think they're getting anything. So for example, the possibility of nuclear threats has not done anything to dissuade Western countries from imposing very severe economic sanctions. It hasn't done anything to dissuade them from channeling significant types of military assistance to Ukraine. And the constraints that apply to the West apply equally to Russia. So for example, it would be very much in Russia's military advantage to bomb supply routes through Poland that are being used to channel weapons into Ukraine, but they won't do it for the exact same reason the United States is not gonna, you know, impose a no-fly zone. So Russia is both constrained and empowered. Right. And then finally, nukes are useless for changing conventional combat conditions on the ground. You can't use them to take territory or to hold territory. And so Russia is now bogged down in a quagmire and may even lose the conventional battle. And nuclear weapons are completely useless for changing that. So my view is that there's been a gross exaggeration of the benefits of being nuclear armed, and we need to have some vocal pushback on that.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I'm looking forward to the op-ed on that.
I have submitted something to Foreign Policy on Tuesday, and it's been radio silence since. So I pinged them with a follow-up this morning, and if I don't hear from them, I'll try it somewhere else.
Okay, sounds good. Lori and Sarah, would you like to respond to Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. Obviously, you know, when you think back to earlier in the nuclear age, nuclear weapons' role, hopefully, is more and more limited, and that's good. And it's an important point that, in a way, I mean, Putin has been deterred too. I mean, the alliance has held quite well. And we haven't really talked about the other sorts of risks. I think if the war had been going differently and Russia was active throughout Ukraine, one of the things you'd be watching quite closely was interdiction of supplies coming in from the West, coming in from Poland or Slovakia or wherever. And, you know, you can imagine hot pursuit or missiles going astray and some, you know, maybe hitting NATO territory and, you know, big questions suddenly being raised. We haven't got into that position. I mean, again, I think some of the signaling they've been doing, like the attack on the training facility near Lviv and the use of hypersonics, which was a gimmick, I think these are their own ways of sort of reminding NATO to keep out. But the fact is that we're not that worried about Russia trying to extend the war at the moment. And that's the benefit of the alliance. It's why Georgia and Ukraine get attacked, but Estonia doesn't. But I don't think that's a mark against nuclear deterrence. I mean, that's a mark for nuclear deterrence. It helps contain the conflict. What it can't do is help you win a battle. And what it's not that good is coercing you from doing something that you really don't want to do and don't need to do because the risks of of acting on coercive threats are too large. So I think what nuclear weapons do is hopefully, and will continue to do, prevent escalation to major war. That's what they do. Below that, they're not very relevant. But that's not trivial. I mean, that in itself is quite an important impact.
Thanks, Laurie. Sarah?
No, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, I just think that Jeff's point is well taken. And I know, Bill, you know, this is a particular area of interest for us, is kind of understanding how this crisis will impact upon our understanding of the drivers and inhibitors for, you know, acquiring or pursuing a nuclear weapons capability. And I think that's an important point to think about there is, you know, what are the objectives of a state and how would nuclear weapons serve or not serve those goals? And that depends a little bit on what each individual state hopes to get out of nuclear weapons. I think it's a well-made point, and thanks for that, Jeff.
Thanks, Sarah. Jeff, you may be interested. I'll be going to New York in a little over a week for consultations with the NPT PrepCon president and other diplomats, in part to kind of take the pulse and to see how, you know, the war may have impacted the kinds of issues that are raised, the arguments that are raised. And notwithstanding your points, I would be surprised if some states that have in the past been, you know, very skeptical, if not outright hostile to the TPNW, don't cite this very dangerous international security environment as an argument to kind of dismiss as irrelevant, you know, the TPNW. And to make other arguments that they probably held strongly, or at least that they held strongly before, but now see events in Ukraine as an argument to advance their positions. Just as some states will, I think, make the case that more than ever we need to promote Article 6 if, in fact, we're going to avoid the use of nuclear weapons in the future. So I think there are question marks, notwithstanding the logic, what you said about how the war will be used in the discussions to consider new issues, the priority to attach to some of these issues in the NPT context. But maybe have to have another discussion after our conversations in New York to see what's actually happening. But thanks so much, Jeff, for your remarks. Sig, I have you on my list here. Can you hear me, Sig? Okay, great. If you could unmute, then you have the floor. Sig, you are still muted. I see your avatar, but I don't see.
Okay, now can you hear me?
We can.
Very good. I guess it took both of us to make this happen. So I was just saying thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. I wanted to, first of all, and I also very much agreed with Avner Cohen's comments about the real danger and what way up as far as Putin is concerned. But what strikes me here, you know, as we've discussed the issue of nuclear weapons for deterrence, and as Sarah has pointed out, the issue of talking about declaratory policy doesn't really fit here. So what strikes me is what's so different here is the question of the role of nuclear weapons as we deal between a nuclear and a non-nuclear country. And so as has already been pointed out, so the nuclear weapons, they are being used to threaten, they're being used for coercion. And Putin is doing that, you know, within the spirit of having to live, you know, against NATO and the United States. But that's sort of the new wrinkle in this. And what I find really interesting and curious is, Bill, as you well know, you know, I published a book a few years ago called Doom to Cooperate. And one of the fascinating pieces in that book was written by Radi Elkayev, who was my counterpart at Vinyev in Sarov, what we call the Russian Los Alamos. And he wrote a piece called Nuclear Weapons of Russia. And he talked about what the utility of nuclear weapons for Russia are. And so he wrote this piece Actually, initially, he wrote a piece of that nature back in 2000, but then he updated it around 2013, 2014. And what he said, you know, the strategic nuclear weapons are for strategic deterrence and stability, and the tactical nuclear weapons are for regional deterrence and stability. And particularly, what came out of that is the tactical nuclear weapons in the regional context sort of gives Russia freedom of what it can do in its near abroad. And so I remember being really surprised by that, you know, at the time. And that's exactly what I see being, you know, happening right now, is those nuclear weapons giving Russia the freedom to do its things it wants to do in the near abroad. And so that's the comment. And the question is, so Professor Friedman and Sarah, so what do we do about that? How do we adjust now how we deal with nuclear weapons in the context of a nuclear against a non-nuclear country? Thank you.
Thanks, Sig. Good to hear your voice. Lori and Sarah, would you like to respond here?
I mean, what Russia hasn't done is made a direct threat to Ukraine with nuclear weapons, and that's important. And no doubt people will cite that as an example of a failure of deterrence, that in a sense Ukraine has decided to fight, despite the fact that it's a non-nuclear power fighting a nuclear power. And logically, you know, in terms of theories of deterrence, Ukraine is doesn't have an alliance guarantee behind it. It doesn't have a US extended deterrence. So logically, you might think it's something Russia might get away with, but it hasn't really tried. And you know, even the scenarios that people talk about are sort of very limited and marginal, and for that reason don't make a lot of sense. Not obviously, nor would a big nuclear threat, but it's something that hasn't happened. So the main license it gives Russia is to go to war without a concern that the Americans and others will come in on the victims' behalf. The second point just to keep in mind is, you know, again, it comes back to the point, we don't know how this is going to end. And we keep on having to remember this. So, you know, let's assume that following today's statements, the Russians withdraw their forces away from Kyiv and sort of concentrate on the south and the east, and the Ukrainians say, well, we're not putting up with that, and they go after them, and they really start to do well, and they move towards Crimea. Where does Crimea fit in all of this? Because that's been annexed. Even in his statement before the war, Putin didn't go as far as actually annexing Donetsk and Luhansk. So they're, you know, they're the sort of ambiguous issues that could arise in the future. And we don't know this yet, because the war isn't over. Just final point, if Russia gets beat one way or the other, and in a way it's already being humiliated, but it's not fully beat yet, that's in a very important strategic message that other countries will have to take note of. It's not that easy to win this sort of war, even if you're big and powerful. It'll be a very healthy outcome. You know, that's one reason why a lot of us sort of, not only because they're the aggrieved party, but because it's actually a warning to other would-be bullies that it's not, however strong you think you are, armed force is quite a difficult thing to use effectively. You know, please note by Beijing. So I think it's too early to be sure of the lessons that we're gonna learn from this. But there are quite dangerous potential situations that could arise, but there are also, you know, quite benign outcomes that could in the end make the world safer. If Russia tries something very big and fails, that has important consequences.
Thank you, Lori. Sarah?
I was just, I mean, I'm still kind of formulating my thoughts because I think it's a good question, Sig, and it's so nice to see you. So thank you for coming. You know, it strikes me, and I was thinking about this as Lori was responding, that I'm not sure that the distinction between tactical and strategic nuclear weapons is as black and white as Radi Ilkayev maybe described it in that piece. Because, you know, setting aside a scenario where Russia might use nuclear weapons against Ukraine, which I do tend to think is less likely than Russia conducting a limited strike against NATO or somehow there being an accident involving NATO that would somehow bring NATO into a conflict and escalate to nuclear dimensions. I mean, it's really the use of tactical nuclear weapons almost for strategic purposes. We're talking about a theater that is local to Russia, but it is about deterring another nuclear power, which is the United States or NATO. And so, and if they would be using tactical nuclear weapons for that purpose, then that seems to me not to fall in line with the utility of tactical nuclear weapons for regional wars that Radi Ilkayev was describing. So I think there are a lot of questions around sort of how does force posture align with declaratory policy, align with things that various people have said in the kind of military strategic community in Russia, and it's hard to sort out all of those pieces. And so that's something that I am going to be thinking about as the war continues, kind of trying to understand not just the mission sets of different weapons, but how are they used in different contexts and how are they invoked in different contexts for different purposes. So thank you for that really thought-provoking question, Sig.
Thanks, Sarah. I think the other, if I can kind of also weigh in a little bit here, I think we have to be very careful about the rationales that we apply to Russian non-strategic nuclear weapons today. And recall that these weapons were developed in a very different environment in the Soviet Union period. And the whole concept of a kind of regional conflict is certainly very different today than what it looked like when these weapons were developed. And in fact, in conversations that I remember having with Russian defense analysts and policymakers in the pre-Russian period, during the Soviet period, when there were questions about the utility of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons vis-a-vis the West, their response, if they were candid, and it was a very private conversation, was we're not looking westward, we're looking to the South, we're looking toward China. And so I think the rationales have changed significantly, and I would be careful not to attribute the reason for the development of these tactical nuclear weapons with how they may be used today for deterrence or other purposes. We have time probably for one more question. I see Avner has his hand up. I wanna first though make sure there's nobody else in the audience who hasn't spoken who would like to ask a question. So I'll pause for 10 seconds to see if anybody else wants to raise their hand. And if not, I will return the mic to Avner. And I don't see anybody else's virtual hand being raised here. So Avner, you have a second shot here.
You hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. There is one more scenario which has been mentioned. I don't think it's very likely. I hope it's not very likely, but I think it's worth thinking about, and I wonder your response to that. So let me articulate that scenario. The scenario is that we are now beginning the second month of the war. We do not see, as of now, any solution, any settlement in the horizon. It could become a war of attrition that could take weeks from now. Some people even say month. It's difficult for me to see that, but we do not see out of that. There is one scenario that Russia might use demonstration of nuclear weapon as a way to bring a surrender or at least a submission of Ukraine to sign a deal to end the war in its own terms. So I wonder what you think about it, using nuclear weapons as a coercion weapons to push a state to sign some kind of submissions to end that kind of conflict.
Thank you, Avner. And let me, since I see one of our younger colleagues, Noah May, who's also asked a question in chat. Noah, if you would you like to ask your question directly, or I can read it if you. Are you there, Noah? I'm gonna give you the chance to ask your question. Okay, I don't see Noah connecting here, Caitlin. So Noah asks the speakers if they would like to comment on, is it possible in the near term? Oh, let me just read it. He says, I'm interested in the speakers' views on what would be more effective and more possible in the near term for mitigating the nuclear risks of the war, attempts at high top-level engagement or engagement at the working level, perhaps representatives in New York, Geneva, Vienna, diplomatic missions or otherwise. So if you want to address that question, I would appreciate it. And this would perhaps also be a time for kind of closing remarks if you would like to make any. So first, Lori, I'll give you the floor to respond to Avner and anything else you'd like to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be very difficult for Russia to start doing demonstration shots and so on. First, there's a possibility it may flop, which, as you know, was the problem with a demonstration shot before Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. They were worried they'd have all the supply and then it would be a dud. And, you know, there were reports of goodness knows how many of the Russian missiles turning out to be duds already in this war. And certainly, if you have a demonstration shot, it suggests you're actually really rather nervous about doing the real thing. I think we just have a credibility problem. And the Ukrainian mood is pretty robust at the moment. They think they're winning, they'd have to be very sure of the threat before they shifted on that, and it would bring in I just don't see it. I think the question of high level, I mean, I'm all in favor of low level conversations going on. I think high level are very difficult at the moment. I mean, Putin and talks with a number of people he's talking with Scholz, he's talking with Macron, he's talked with Naftali Bennett, who's actually been in Russia. Maybe Erdogan's playing a role. There's all sorts of would-be mediators around, but in the end, it depends on the Ukrainians. It's their war. They're the ones who are going to have to decide that, and it's very dangerous. And I think this is how it would be seen if there was a Biden-Putin conversation, which people assumed would lead to Biden agreeing on the concessions Ukraine should offer. I just don't think that's would be advisable or send the right messages. But conversations to keep an eye on what's going on. I'm in favor of people trying to talk to Putin to try to knock some sense into him. But I think you have to be cautious about what that's going to do. In the end, this war ends when Putin decides he's had enough. It's not up to Zelensky even. I mean, he can, because public opinion behind him is overwhelming that they carry on with this war as long as it takes. Whereas Putin is a lonelier man, it is existential for him, but it's not existential for Russia. And he's the one who's gonna have to work this out. And as we've got no idea what's going on in his mind, it's very hard to work out how this does end, but end it will at some point. I think it ends more likely with Russia looking for a way out than Ukraine, but it's some way from that probably, I'm afraid.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Sarah, some responses and closing remarks?
Sure, thank you, Bill, and thank you, Laurie, for those comments. Avner, to your question, that's the third alternative that I've kind of heard floated as well, that Russia could conduct some kind of a demonstration detonation and that it would be aimed at driving, Ukraine to the negotiating table. I think having just had this conversation about the importance of not extrapolating too much from Russian declaratory policy or Russian force posture or doctrine, I don't want to kind of fall into that trap, but I do think that would be pretty far outside of the line of the way that Russia envisions using non-strategic nuclear weapons, at least based on my understanding. I mean, to me, And the way that I understand it, those are weapons that you invoke when you have run out of conventional options and you don't want to back down in the face of an existential threat. I don't really see them being invoked in a conflict where you haven't yet reached that point and where there is not an existential threat to Russia, as we were talking about. But to Lori's point just now, we don't know what is going on inside Putin's head. And you know, we don't know whether he will consider himself to be facing an existential threat or at what point that will happen. So I think we need to be, you know, a little bit kind of open-ended there based on the many ambiguities about how things will evolve over the next weeks, hopefully not months, but we'll see. As far as, you know, continuing engagement, I also think that's really important. I think that it will be easier to continue engagement at low levels to some extent, but I'm not sure that, I mean, that's not going to be the thing that will be ultimately effective in, you know, facilitating some kind of, if we're talking about arms control, you know, US-Russia arms control agreement or anything like that. We really need, in my view, high level, you know, institutional advocacy for arms control. And that's not going to happen until the immediate crisis has been resolved, or indeed, to harken back to my earlier comments, possibly for many months after that has actually happened. So but I do think that's going to be the thing that will bring both sides back to the negotiating table if that indeed turns out to be possible. And we'll just have to see whether there's sufficient political will on either side for that. And if so, when that kind of political will might be available. And right now, those are just big unknowns. So I think I'll end there, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I want to express my tremendous appreciation to our two speakers for what was an exceptionally stimulating conversation. Also very appreciative of the audience for asking probing questions. Obviously, we are looking at a conflict that has a long way to go before it plays out, and we may need to return to some of the issues that we've discussed today moving forward. I just wanna again express my gratitude to all of you for today's discussions. We will be putting a version of this up on our YouTube channel. So if you missed anything or you want to revisit what Sarah and Lori said, you'll have that opportunity. I wish you all the best and look forward to seeing some of you on television in the not too distant future. So take care, everybody. Have a good day.